From the primer, Princess Nell crosses the trail of the enigmatic mouse army. A visit to an invalid. The clearing, dimly visible through the trees ahead, was a welcome sight, for the forests of King Coyote were surpassingly deep and forever shrouded in cool mists. Fingers of sunlight had begun to thrust between the clouds, and so Princess Nell decided to rest in the open space and, with any luck, bask in the sunlight. But when she reached the clearing, she found that it was not the flower-strewn greensward she had expected. It was, rather, a swath that had been carved through the forest by the passage of some titanic force, which had flattened trees and churned up the soil as it progressed. When Princess Nell had recovered from her astonishment and mastered her fear, she resolved to make use of the tracking skills she had learned during her many adventures, so as to learn something about the nature of this unknown creature. As she soon discovered, the skills of an advanced tracker were not necessary in this case. The merest glance at the trampled soil revealed not, as she had anticipated, a few enormous footprints, but millions of tiny ones, superimposed upon one another in such numbers that no scrap of ground was unmarked by the impressions of tiny claws and footpads. A torrent of cats had passed this way. Even had Princess Nell not recognized the footprints, the balls of loose hair and tiny scats strewn everywhere would have told the story. Cats moving in a herd. It was most unfeline behavior. Nell followed their track for some time, hoping to divine the cause of this prodigy. After a few miles, the road widened into an abandoned camp freckled with the remains of innumerable small campfires. Nell combed this area for more clues, not without success. She found many mouse droppings here, and mouse footprints around the fires. The pattern of footprints made it clear that the cats had been concentrated in a few small areas, while the mice had apparently had the run of the place. The final piece of the puzzle was a tiny scrap of twisted rawhide that Nell found abandoned near one of the little campfires. Turning it around in her fingers, Nell realized that it was much like a horse's bridle, except sized to fit around the head of a cat. She was standing on the trail of a vast army of mice who rode on the backs of cats in the way that knights ride on horses. She had heard tales of the mouse army in other parts of the land beyond and dismissed them as ancient superstitions. But once, several years ago, in an inn high in the mountains where Princess Nell had stayed for the night, she had been awakened early in the morning by the sound of a mouse rooting through her pack. Princess Nell uttered a light-making spell that Purple had taught her, kindling a ball of luminance that hung in the air in the center of the room. The words of the spell had been concealed in the howl of the mountain winds through the rickety structure of the old inn, and so the mouse was caught entirely by surprise, blinded by the sudden light. Nell was startled to see that the mouse was not gnawing its way into her supply of food, as any mouse should have done, but rather was going through some of her papers. And this was not the usual destructive search for nesting material. This mouse knew how to read, and was looking for information. Princess Nell trapped the mouse spy under her hands. "What are you looking for?" "Tell me, and I shall let you escape," she said. Her adventures had taught her to be on the lookout for tricks of all kinds, and it was important that she learn who had dispatched this tiny but effective spy.
"I am but a harmless mouse," the spy squealed. "I do not even desire your food. Information only."
"I will give you a big piece of cheese all to yourself if you give me some information," Princess Nell said. She caught the mouse's tail and lifted him up into the air so that they could talk face to face. Meanwhile, with her other hand, she loosened the drawstring of her bag and drew out a nice piece of blue-veined Stilton.
"We are seeking our lost queen," the mouse said.
"I can assure you that none of my papers have any information about a missing mouse monarch," Princess Nell said.
"What is your name?"
the mouse said. "That is none of your business, spy," Princess Nell said. "I will ask the questions."
"But it is very important that I know your name,"
the mouse said. "Why?" "I am not a mouse. I have not seen any little mice with crowns on their heads." The mouse spy said nothing. He was staring carefully at Princess Nell with his little beady eyes.
"Did you by any chance come from an enchanted island?"
"You have been listening to too many fairy tales," Princess Nell said, barely concealing her astonishment. "You have been most uncooperative and so do not deserve any cheese." but I admire your pluck, and so will give you some anyway. Enjoy yourself." She set the mouse down on the floor and took out her knife to cut off a bit of the cheese. But by the time she was finished, the mouse had disappeared. She just caught sight of his pink tail disappearing under the door. The next morning, she found him dead on the hallway floor. The innkeeper's cat had caught him. So the mouse army did exist. Princess Nell wondered whether they had ever located their lost queen. She followed their trail for another day or two, as it went in approximately the right direction and was almost as convenient as a road. She passed through a few more campsites. At one of them, she even found a little grave site marked with a tiny headstone carved from a chip of soapstone. The carvings on this tiny monument were much too small to see, but Princess Nell carried with her a magnifying glass that she had pilfered from the treasury of one of the fairy kings, and so now she removed it from its padded box and its velvet bag and used it to examine the inscription. At the top of the stone was a little bas-relief of a mouse knight, dressed in armor, with a sword in one hand, bowing before an empty throne. The inscription read, "Here lies Clover, tail and all. Her virtues far outweighed her flaws. She from the saddle took a fall and perished neath her charger's paws. We know not if her final ride hath led her into heaven or hell. Wherever she doth now abide, she's loyal yet to Princess Nell." Princess Nell examined the remains of the fires and the surfaces of the wood that the mouse army had cut and the state of their droppings, and estimated that they had passed by here many weeks previously. One day she would rendezvous with them and find out why they had formed such an attachment to her, but for now she had more pressing considerations. She'd have to see about the mouse army later. Today was Saturday, and on Saturday mornings she always went down to the leased territories to visit her brother. She opened up the wardrobe in the corner of her sleeping room and took out her traveling dress. Sensing her intentions, the chaperone flew out of its niche in the back and whined over to the door. Even at her still tender age, just a few years past the threshold of womanhood, Nell had already had cause to be grateful for the presence of the droning chaperone pod that followed her everywhere when she ventured from home alone. Maturity had given her any number of features that would draw the attention of the opposite sex, and of women so inclined. Commentators rarely failed to mention her eyes, which were said to have a vaguely exotic appearance. There was nothing particularly unusual about their shape or size, and their color, a tweedy blend of green and light brown flecked with gold, did not make them stand out in a predominantly Anglo-Saxon culture. But Nell's eyes had an appearance of feral alertness that seized the attention of anyone who met her. Neo-Victorian society produced many young women who, though highly educated and well-read, were still blank slates at Nell's age. But Nell's eyes told a different story. When she had been presented to society a few months ago, along with several other external propagation girls at Miss Matheson's academy, she had not been the prettiest girl at the dance, and certainly not the best dressed or most socially prominent. She had attracted a crowd of young men anyway. They did not do anything so obvious as mill around her. Instead, they tried to keep the distance between themselves and Nell below a certain maximum, so that wherever she went in the ballroom, the local density of young men in her area became unusually high. In particular, she had excited the interest of a boy who was the nephew of an equity lord in Atlantis, Toronto. He had written her several ardent letters. She had responded saying that she did not wish to continue the relationship, and he had, perhaps with the help of a hidden monitor, encountered her and her chaperone pod one morning as she had been riding to Miss Matheson's academy. She had reminded him of the recent termination of their relationship by declining to recognize him, but he had persisted anyway, and by the time she had reached the gates of the academy, the chaperone pod had gathered enough evidence to support a formal sexual harassment accusation, should Nell have wished to bring one. Of course she did not, because this would have created a cloud of opprobrium that would have blighted the young man's career. Instead, she excerpted one 5-second piece of the cine record from the chaperone pod, the one in which, approached by the young man, Nell said, "I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you have me at a disadvantage," and the young man, failing to appreciate the ramifications, pressed on as if he had not heard. Nell placed this information into a smart visiting card and arranged to have it dropped by the young man's family home. A formal apology was not long in coming, and she did not hear again from the young man. Now that she had been introduced to society, her preparations for a visit to the leased territories were just as elaborate as for any New Atlantis lady. Outside of New Atlantis, she and her chevaline were surrounded everywhere by a shell of hovering security pods serving as a first line of personal defense. A modern lady chevaline was designed with a sort of Y-shaped body that made it unnecessary to ride side saddle. So Nell was able to wear a fairly normal-looking sort of dress, a bodice that took advantage of her fashionably narrow waist, so carefully honed on the Academy's exercise machines that it might have been turned on a lathe from walnut. Beyond that, her skirts, sleeves, collar, and hat saw to it that none of the young ruffians of the leased territories would have the opportunity to invade her body space with their eyes, and lest her distinctive face prove too much of a temptation, she wore a veil, too. The veil was a field of microscopic, umbrella-like aerostats programmed to fly in a sheet formation a few inches in front of Nell's face. The umbrellas were all pointed away from her. Normally they were furled, which made them nearly invisible. They looked like the merest shadow before her face. Though viewed sideways, they created a subtle wall of shimmer in the air. At a command from Nell, they would open to some degree. When fully opened, they nearly touched each other. The outside-facing surfaces were reflective, the inner ones matte black, so Nell could see out as if she were looking through a piece of smoked glass. But others saw only the shimmering veil. The umbrellas could be programmed to dangle in different ways, always maintaining the same collective shape, like a fencing mask, or rippling like a sheet of fine silk, depending on the current mode. The veil offered Nell protection from unwanted scrutiny. Many New Atlantis career women also used the veil as a way of meeting the world on their own terms, ensuring that they were judged on their own merits and not on their appearance. It served a protection function as well, bouncing back the harmful rays of the sun and intercepting many deleterious namicites that might otherwise slip unhindered into the nose and mouth. The latter function was of particular concern to Constable Moore on this morning.
"That's been nasty of late," he said. "The fighting has been very bad."
Nell had already inferred this from certain peculiarities of the constable's behavior. He had been staying up late at night recently, managing some complicated enterprise spread out across his mediatronic floor, and she suspected that it was something along the lines of a battle, or even a war. As she rode her chevaline across Dovetail, she came to a height of land that afforded a fine view across the leased territories, Pudong, and Shanghai on a clear day. But the humidity had congealed into drifts of clouds, forming a seamless layer about 1,000 feet below their level, so that this high territory at the top of New Chuzan seemed to be an island, the only land in all the world except for the snow-capped cone of the Nippon Clave a few miles up the coast. She departed through the main gate and rode down the hill. She kept approaching the cloud layer but never quite reached it. The lower she went, the softer the light became, and after a few minutes she could no longer see the rambling settlements of Dovetail when she turned around, nor the spires of St. Mark's and Source Victoria above it. After another few minutes' descent, the fog became so thick that she could not see more than a few meters, and she smelled the elemental reek of the ocean. She passed the former site of the Sendero Clave. The Senderos had been bloodily uprooted when protocol enforcement figured out they were working in concert with the new Taiping rebels, a fanatical cult opposed to both the Fists and the Coastal Republic. This patch of real estate had since passed into the hands of the Dong, an ethnic minority tribe from southwestern China, driven out of their homeland by the Civil War. They had torn down the high wall and thrown up one of their distinctive many-layered pagodas. Other than that, the LT didn't look all that different. The operators of the big wall-sized mediatrons that had so terrified Nell on her first night in the leased territories had turned the brightness all the way up, trying to compensate for the fog. Down by the waterfront, not far from the aerodrome, the compilers of New Chuzan had, as a charitable gesture, made some space available to the Vatican. In the early years, it had contained nothing more than a two-story mission for thieves who had followed their lifestyle to its logical conclusion and found themselves homeless, addicted, hounded by debtors, or on the run from the law or abusive members of their own families. More recently, those had become secondary functions, and the Vatican had programmed the building's foundation to extrude many more stories. The Vatican had a number of serious ethical concerns about nanotech, but had eventually decided that it was okay as long as it didn't mess about with DNA or create direct interfaces with the human brain. Using nanotech to extrude buildings was fine, and that was fortunate, because Vatican Shanghai needed to add a couple of floors to the Free Thysis Sanatorium every year. Now it loomed high above any of the other waterfront buildings. As with any other extruded building, the design was drab in the extreme, each floor exactly alike. The walls were of an unexceptional beige material that had been used to construct many of the buildings in the LT, which was unfortunate, because it had an almost magnetic attraction for the cinericious corpses of airborne mites. Like all the other buildings so constituted, the Free Thysis Sanatorium had, over the years, turned black, and not evenly, but in vertical rain streaks. It was a cliché to joke that the outside of the sanatorium looked much like the inside of its tenants' lungs. The Fists of Righteous Harmony had, however, done their best to pretty it up by slapping red posters over it in the dead of night. Harv was lying on the top of a 3-layer bunk bed on the 20th floor, sharing a small room and a supply of purified air with a dozen other chronic asthma sufferers. His face was goggled into a phantoscope, and his lips were wrapped around a thick tube plugged into a nebulizer socket on the wall. Vaporized drugs straight from the matter compiler were flowing down that tube and into his lungs, working to keep his bronchi from spasming shut. Nell stopped for a moment before breaking him out of his reactive. Some weeks he looked better than others. This week he did not look good. His body was bloated, his face round and heavy, his fingers swollen to puffy cylinders. They had been giving him heavy steroid treatments. But she would have known he'd had a bad week anyway, because usually Harv didn't go in for immersive reactives. He liked the kind you held in your lap on a sheet of smart paper. Nell tried to send Harv a letter every day, simply written in mediaglyphics, and for a while he had tried to respond in kind. Last year, he had even given up on this, though she wrote him faithfully anyway. "Nell," he said when he'd peeled the goggles away from his eyes. "Sorry, I was chasing some rich Vickies."
"You were?"
"Yeah, or Burley Scud was, I mean, in the reactive. See, Burley's bitch gets pregnant, and she's got to buy herself a freedom machine to get rid of it. So she gets a job as a maid of all work for some snotty Vickies and rips off some of their nice old stuff, figuring that's a faster way to get the money. So the bitch is running away, and they're chasing her on their chevs, and then Burley Scud shows up in his big truck and turns the tables and starts chasing them. If you do it right, you can get the Vickies to fall into a big pit of manure. It's great. You should try it," Harv said. Then, exhausted by this effort, grabbed his oxygen tube and pulled on it for a while.
"It sounds entertaining," Nell said.
Harv, temporarily gagged by the oxygen tube, watched her face carefully and was not convinced.
"Sorry," he blurted between breaths. "Forgot you don't care for my kind of reactive. Don't they have Burley Scud in that primer of yours?"
Nell made herself smile at the joke which Harv had been making every week. She handed him the basket of cookies and fresh fruit that she had brought down from Dovetail and sat with him for an hour, talking about the things he enjoyed talking about, until she could see his attention wandering back toward the goggles. Then she said goodbye until next week and kissed him goodbye. She turned her veil to its highest level of opacity and made her way toward the door. Harv impulsively grabbed his oxygen tube and sucked on it mightily a few times, then called her name just as she was about to leave.
"Yes," she said, turning toward him.
"Now, I want to tell you how fine you look," he said, "just like the finest Vicky lady in all of Atlantis. I can't believe you're my same Nell that I used to bring things to in the old flat. Remember those days? I know that you and I have gone different ways ever since that morning in Dovetail, and I know it's got a lot to do with that primer. I just want to tell you, sister, that even though I say bad stuff about Vicky sometimes, I'm as proud of you as I could be. And I hope when you read that primer, so full of stuff I could never understand or even read, you'll think back on your brother Harv, who saw it lying in the gutter years ago and took it into his mind to bring it to his kid sister. Will you remember that, Nell?"
With that,
He plugged the oxygen tube back into his mouth, and his ribs began to heave.
"Of course I will, Harv,"
Nell said, her eyes filling with tears, and blundered her way back across the room until she could sweep Harv's bloated body up in her strong arms. The veil swirled like a sheet of water thrown into Harv's face, all the little umbrellas drawing themselves out of the way as she brought his face up to hers and planted a kiss on his cheek. The veil congealed again as he sank back down onto the foam mattress, just like the mattresses he had taught her to get from the MC long ago, and she turned and ran out of the room sobbing.
Hackworth is brought up to date by the great Napier.
"Have you had the opportunity to speak with your family?"
Colonel Napier said, speaking out of a Mediatronic tabletop from his office in Atlanta's Shanghai. Hackworth was sitting in a pub in Atlanta's Vancouver. Napier looked good now that he was deeper into middle age, somewhat more imposing. He'd been working on his bearing. Hackworth had been temporarily impressed when Napier's image had first materialized on the Mediatron, then he remembered his own image in the mirror. Once he had gotten himself cleaned up and trimmed his beard, which he decided to keep, he realized that he had a new bearing of his own, even if he was desperately confused about how he got it.
"Thought I'd find out what the hell happened first. Besides..."
He stopped talking for a while. He was having trouble getting his conversational rhythm back.
"Yes?"
Napier said in a labored display of patience.
"I just spoke to Fiona this morning."
"After you left the tunnels?"
"No. Before. Before I woke up, or whatever."
Napier was slightly taken aback, and only popped his jaw muscles a couple of times, reached for his tea, looked irrelevantly out the window at whatever view he had out his office window in New Chusan. Hackworth, on the other side of the Pacific, contented himself with staring into the inky depths of a pint of stout. A dream image surfaced in Hackworth's mind, like a piece of debris rising to the surface after a shipwreck, inexorably muscling tons of green murk out of its path. He saw a glistening blue projectile shoot into the doctor's beige-gloved hands, trailing a thick cord, watched it unfold, nay, bloom into a baby.
"Why did I think of that?" he said.
Napier seemed puzzled by this remark.
"Fiona and Gwendolyn are in Atlanta, Seattle now, half an hour from your present location by tube," he said. "Of course, they live, we live, in Seattle now. I knew that."
Hackworth was remembering Fiona hiking around in the caldera of some snow-covered volcano.
"If you are under the impression that you've been in contact with her recently, which is quite out of the question, I'm afraid, then it must have been mediated through the Prima. We were not able to break the encryption on the signals passing out of the drummer's cave, but traffic analysis suggests that you've spent a lot of time racting in the last 10 years.
10 years?
"Yes. But surely you must have suspected that from evidence," Napier said.
"It feels like 10 years. I sense that 10 years of things have happened to me. But the engineer hemisphere has a bit of trouble coming to grips."
"We're at a loss to understand why Dr. X would choose to have you serve out your sentence among the drummers," Napier said. "It would seem to us that your engineer hemisphere, as you put it, is your most desirable feature as far as he is concerned. You know that the Celestials are still terribly short of engineers."
"I've been working on something," Hackworth said.
Images of a nanotechnological system, something admirably compact and elegant, were flashing over his mind's eye. It seemed to be very nice work, the kind of thing he could produce only when he was concentrating very hard for a long time, as, for example, a prisoner might do.
"What sort of thing exactly?" Napier asked, suddenly sounding rather tense.
"Can't get a grip on it," Hackworth finally said, shaking his head helplessly.
The detailed images of atoms and bonds had been replaced in his mind's eye by a fat brown seed hanging in space, like something in a Magritte painting. A lush, bifurcated curve on one end, like buttocks, converging to a nipple-like point on the other.
What the hell happened?
Before you left Shanghai, Dr. X hooked you up to a matter compiler, no?
Yes.
Did he tell you what he was putting into your system?
I guessed it was hemocules of some description.
We took blood samples before you left Shanghai.
You did?
We have ways, Colonel Napier said. We also did a full workup on one of your friends from the cave and found several million nanocytes in her brain.
Several million?
Very small ones, Napier said reassuringly. They are introduced through the blood, of course. The hemocules circulate through the bloodstream until they find themselves passing through capillaries in the brain, at which point they cut through the blood-brain barrier and fasten themselves to a nearby axon. They can monitor activity in the axon or trigger it. These sites all talk to each other with visible light.
So when I was on my own, my sites just talked to themselves, Hackworth said. But when I came into close proximity with other people who had these things in their brains, it didn't matter which brain a site was in, Napier said. They all talked to one another indiscriminately, forming a network. Get some drummers together in a dark room, and they become a gestalt society.
But the interface between these nanocytes and the brain itself...
Yes, I admit that a few million of these things piggybacking on randomly chosen neurons is only a feeble interface to something as complicated as the human brain, Napier said. We're not claiming that you shared one brain with these people.
So what did I share with them exactly? Hackworth said.
Food, air, companionship, body fluids, perhaps emotions or general emotional states, probably more.
That's all I did for 10 years.
You did a lot of things, Napier said, but you did them in a sort of unconscious, dreamlike state. You were sleepwalking. When we figured that out after doing the biopsy on your fellow troglodyte, we realized that in some sense you were no longer acting of your own free will, and we engineered a hunter-killer that would seek out and destroy the nanocytes in your brain. We introduced it in a dormant mode into this female drummer's system, then reintroduced her to your colony. When you had sex with her, well, you can work out the rest for yourself.
You have given me information, Colonel Napier, and I am grateful. But it has only made me more confused.
What do you suppose the Celestial Kingdom wanted with me? Did Dr. X ask anything of you?
To seek the alchemist.
Colonel Napier looked startled. He asked that of you 10 years ago?
Yes, in as many words.
That is very singular, Napier said, after a prolonged interlude of mustache twiddling. We have only been aware of this shadowy figure for some 5 years, and know virtually nothing about him, other than he is a wizardly artifex who is conspiring with Dr. X.
Is there any other information?
Nothing that I can reveal, Napier said brusquely, perhaps having revealed too much already. Do let us know if you find him, though.
Hackworth, there is no tactful way to broach this subject. Are you aware that your wife has divorced you?
Oh, yes, Hackworth said quietly. I suppose I did know that.
But he hadn't been conscious of it until now. She was remarkably understanding about your long absence, Napier said. But at some point, it became evident that, like all the drummers, you had become sexually promiscuous in the extreme.
How did she know?
We warned her.
Pardon me?
I mentioned earlier that we found things in your blood. These hemocules were designed specifically to be spread through exchange of bodily fluids.
How do you know that?
Napier seemed impatient for the first time.
For God's sake, man, we know what we are doing.
These particles had two functions: spread through exchange of bodily fluids and interact with each other. Once we saw that, we had no ethical choice but to inform your wife.
Of course. That's only right. As a matter of fact, I thank you for it, Hackworth said. And it's not hard to understand Gwen's feelings about sharing bodily fluids with thousands of drummers.
You shouldn't beat yourself up, Napier said. We've sent explorers down there.
Really?
Yes, the drummers don't mind.
The explorers relate that the drummers behave much the way people do in dreams. Poorly defined ego boundaries was the phrase, as I recall. In any event, your behavior down there wasn't necessarily a moral transgression as such. Your mind wasn't your own.
You said that these particles interact with each other?
Each one is a container for some rod logic and some memory, Napier said. When one particle encounters another, either in vivo or in vitro, they dock and seem to exchange data for a few moments. Most of the time, they disengage and drift apart. Sometimes, they stay docked for a while, and computation takes place. We can tell because the rod logic throws off heat. Then they disconnect. Sometimes, both particles go their separate ways. Sometimes, one of them goes dead. But one of them always keeps going. The implications of that last sentence were not lost on Hackworth.
Do the drummers only have sex with one another, or...
That was our first question, too, Napier said. The answer is no. They have a very good deal of sex with many, many other people. They actually run bordellos in Vancouver. They cater especially to the aerodrome and tube station crowd. A few years ago, they came into conflict with the established bordellos because they were hardly charging any money at all for their services. They raised their prices just to be diplomatic. But they don't want the money. What on earth would they do with it? From the Primer, a visit to Castle Turing. A final chat with Miss Matheson. Speculation as to Nell's destiny. Farewell. Conversation with a grizzled hoplite. Nell goes forth to seek her fortune. The new territory into which Princess Nell had crossed was by far the largest and most complex of all the fairy kingdoms in the Primer. Paging back to the first panoramic illustration, she counted 7 major castles perched on the mountaintops, and she knew perfectly well that she would have to visit all of them and do something difficult in each one in order to retrieve the 11 keys that had been stolen from her and the 1 key that remained. She made herself some tea and sandwiches, and carried them in a basket to a meadow where she liked to sit among the wildflowers and read. Constable Moore's house was a melancholy place without the constable in it, and it had been several weeks since she had seen him. During the last 2 years, he had been called away on business with increasing frequency, vanishing, as she supposed, into the interior of China for days, then weeks at a time, coming back depressed and exhausted to find solace in whiskey, which he consumed in surprisingly moderate quantities, but with fierce concentration, and in midnight bagpipe recitals that woke up everyone in Dovetail and a few sensitive sleepers in the New Atlantis clave. During her trip from the campsite of the Mouse Army to the first of the castles, Nell had to use all the wilderness skills she had learned in years of traveling around the land beyond. She fought with a mountain lion, avoided a bear, forded streams, lit fires, built shelters. By the time Nell had maneuvered Princess Nell to the ancient moss-covered gates of the first castle, the sun was shining horizontally across the meadow, and the air was becoming a bit chilly. Nell wrapped herself up in a thermogenic shawl and set the thermostat for something a little on the cool side of comfortable. She had found that her wits became dull if she got too cozy. The basket had a thermos of hot tea with milk, and the sandwiches would hold out for a while. The highest of the castle's many towers was surmounted by a great 4-sailed windmill that turned steadily, even though only a mild breeze could be noticed at Princess Nell's altitude, hundreds of feet below. Set into the main gate was a Judas gate, and set into the Judas was a small hatch. Below the hatch was a great bronze knocker made in the shape of a letter T, though its shape had become indistinct from an encrustation of moss and lichens. Princess Nell operated the knocker only with some effort and, given its decrepit state, did not expect a response. But hardly had the first knock sounded than the hatch opened up and she was confronted by a helmet. For the gatekeeper on the other side was dressed from head to toe in a rusty and moss-covered suit of battle armor. But the gatekeeper said nothing, simply stared at Princess Nell, or so she assumed, as she could not see his face through the helmet's narrow vision slits. "Good afternoon,"
said Princess Nell. I beg your pardon, but I am a traveler in these parts, and I wonder if you would be so good as to give me a place to stay for the night. Without a word, the gatekeeper slammed the hatch closed. Nell could hear the creaking and clanking of his armor as he slowly marched away. Some minutes later, she heard him coming toward her again, though this time the noise was redoubled. The rusty locks on the Judas Gate grumbled and shrieked, the gate door swung open, and Princess Nell stepped back from it as rust flakes, fragments of lichens, and divots of moss showered down around her. Two men in armor now stood there, beckoning her forward. Nell stepped through the gate and into the dark streets of the castle. The gate slammed behind her. An iron vise clamped around each of Princess Nell's upper arms. The men had seized her with their gauntlets. They lifted her into the air and carried her for some minutes through the streets, stairs, and corridors of the castle. These were completely deserted. She did not see so much as a mouse or a rat. No smoke rose from the chimneys, no light came from any window, and in the long hallway leading to the throne room, the torches hung cold and blackened in their sconces. From place to place, Nell saw another armored soldier standing at attention. But, as none of them moved, she did not know whether these were empty suits of armor or real men. Nowhere did she see the usual signs of commerce and human activity. Horse manure, orange peels, barking dogs, running sewers. Somewhat to her alarm, she did see an inordinate number of chains. The chains were all of the same, somewhat peculiar design, and she saw them everywhere, piled up in heaps on street corners, overflowing from metal baskets, dangling from rooftops strung between towers. The clanking and squeaking of the men who bore her along made it difficult for her to hear anything else. But as they proceeded higher and deeper into the castle, she slowly became conscious of a deep, grinding, growling noise that pervaded the very ashlars. This noise crescendoed as they hustled down the long, final hallway and became nearly earth-shaking as they finally entered the vaulted throne room at the very heart of the castle. The room was dark and cold, though some light was admitted by clerestory windows high up in the vaults. The walls were lined with men in armor, standing stock still. Sitting in the middle of the room, on a throne twice as high as a man, was a giant, dressed in a suit of armor that gleamed like a looking glass. Standing below him was a man in armor holding a rag and a wire brush, vigorously buffing one of the lord's greaves.
"Welcome to Castle Turing," said the lord in a metallic voice.
By this time, Princess Nell's eyes had adjusted to the dimness, and she could see something else behind the throne. A tremendous shaft, as thick as the mainmast of a dromond, made of the trunk of a great tree bound and reinforced with brass plates and bands. The shaft turned steadily, and Princess Nell realized that it must be transmitting the power of the giant windmill far above them. Enormous gears, black and sticky with grease, were attached to the shaft and transferred its power to other, smaller shafts that ran off horizontally in every direction and disappeared through holes in the walls. The turning and grinding of all these shafts and gears made the omnipresent noise she had noted earlier. One horizontal shaft ran along each wall of the throne room at about the height of a man's chest. This shaft passed through a gearbox at short, regular intervals. A stubby, square shaft projected from each gearbox at a right angle, sticking straight out of the wall. These gearboxes tended to coincide with the locations of the soldiers. The soldier who was polishing the lord's armor worked his way around to one of the lord's spiked knee protectors and, in so doing, turned his back on Princess Nell. She was startled to see a large square hole in the middle of his back. Nell knew, vaguely, that the name Castle Turing was a hint. She'd learned a bit about Turing at Miss Matheson's academy. He had something to do with computers. She could have turned to the encyclopedia pages and looked it right up, but she had learned to let the primer tell the story its own way. Clearly, the soldiers were not men in armor, but simply wind-up men, and the same was probably true of the Duke of Turing himself. After a short and not very interesting conversation, during which Princess Nell tried unsuccessfully to establish whether the Duke was or was not human, he announced unemotionally that he was throwing her into the dungeon forever.
This sort of thing no longer surprised or upset Nell, because it had happened hundreds of times during her relationship with the Primer. Besides, she had known from the very first day Harve had given her the book how the story would come out in the end. It was just that the story was unfractious. It developed more ramifications the more closely she read it. One of the soldiers detached himself from his gearbox on the wall, stomped into the corner, and picked up a metal basket filled with one of those peculiar chains Princess Nell had seen everywhere. He carried it to the throne, fished through it until he found the end, and fed the end into a hole on the side of the throne. In the meantime, a second soldier had also detached himself from the wall and taken up a position on the opposite side of the throne. This soldier flipped his visor open to expose some sort of a mechanical device in the space where his head ought to have been. A tremendous chattering noise arose from inside the throne. The second soldier caught the end of the chain as it was emerging from his side and fed it into the opening in his visor. A moment later, it popped out of a hatch on his chest. In this fashion, the entire length of the chain, some 20 or 30 feet in all, was slowly and noisily drawn out of the basket, into the noisy mechanism hidden beneath the throne, down the second soldier's throat, out the hatch in his chest, and down to the floor, where it gradually accumulated into a greasy heap. The process went on for much longer than Princess Nell first anticipated, because the chain frequently changed direction. More than once, when the basket was nearly empty, the chain began to spew back into it until it was nearly full again. But on the whole, it was more apt to go forward than backward, and eventually the last link lifted free from the basket and disappeared into the throne. A few seconds later, the din from the throne stopped. Now Nell could only hear a somewhat lesser chattering from the second soldier. Finally, that stopped as well, and the chain fell from his chest. The soldier scooped it up in his arms and deposited it in an empty basket that was sitting handily nearby. Then he strode toward Nell, bent forward at the waist, put his hard, cold shoulder rather uncomfortably into the pit of her stomach, and picked her up off the floor like a sack of corn. He carried her for some minutes through the castle, most of that time spent descending endless stone staircases, and finally brought her to a very deep, dark, and cold dungeon, where he deposited her in a small and perfectly dark cell. Nell said, Princess Nell used one of the magic spells Purple had taught her to make light. Princess Nell could see that the room was about 2 by 3 paces, with a stone bench on one wall to serve as a bed, and a hole in the floor for a toilet. A tiny barred window in the back wall led to an air shaft. Evidently this was quite deep and narrow, and Nell was close to the very bottom, because no light came through it. The soldier walked out of the cell and pulled the door shut behind him. As he did, she saw that the lock was extraordinarily large, about the size of an iron bread box mounted to the door, full of clockwork and with a large crank dangling from its center. The door was equipped with a small peephole. Peering out through it, Nell could see that the soldier did not have a key as such. Instead, he took a short length of chain about as long as his arm from a peg near the door and fed it into the giant lock. Then he began to turn the crank. The clockwork clicked, the chain clanked, and eventually the bolt shot out and engaged the jamb, locking Princess Nell into the dungeon. Immediately, the chain crashed out of the lock and landed on the floor. The soldier picked it up and hung it back on the wall. Then he clanked away and did not come back until several hours later, when he brought her some bread and water, shoving it through a little hatch in the middle of the door, just above the mechanical lock. It did not take Princess Nell long to explore the limited confines of her cell. In one corner, buried under dust and debris, she found something hard and cold and pulled it out for a better look. It was a fragment of chain, quite rusty, but clearly recognizable as the same sort of chain that she saw all over Castle Turing. The chain was flat. Each link had a toggle, a movable bit of metal in the center, capable of rotating about and snapping into place in either of 2 positions, either parallel or perpendicular to the chain. During her first night in the cell, Nell discovered 2 other things. First, the latch on the little door through which her food was delivered was partly accessible from her side, and with a little effort she was able to jam it so that it no longer locked properly. After that, she was able to stick her head out of the hatch and examine her surroundings, including the mechanical lock. Or she could reach out with one arm and feel the lock, spin the crank, and so on. The second discovery came in the middle of the night, when she was awakened by a metallic clanking sound coming through the tiny window on the air shaft. Reaching out with one hand, she felt the end of a chain dangling there. She pulled on it, and after initial resistance, it came freely. In short order, she was able to pull many yards of chain into her cell and pile it up on the floor.